Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Is Dr. Michelle Cohen, and you are officially on the couch as you always are on Fridays live here on LA Talk Radio. 11 in the morning Pacific Standard Time here in beautiful Los Angeles and wherever you're at joining me in the world. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. As always, I have a wonderful guest. Today is so special because I must say I have never read a book like this. And the reason why I'm saying is because for me, and this is just me, it sort of brings so much hope to us about the concept and all of the rumors and all of the spiritual stuff we hear and all of the medical information we get about the process of dying. Now, I know it's not a happy subject for most of us, but this book that we're going to be talking about today and the author, it's really phenomenal. It's based on case studies. It has some wonderful, enlightening information in it. And so I want you guys to stay tuned. If you have any calls or questions, what I'd love you guys to do today is email me at straighttalkdoc@gmail.com. straighttalkdoc@gmail.com. We're not taking live calls because I really want to keep Dr. We'll introduce him in a minute. Christopher Kirk on the line with me as long as I can. So we're going to just focus on his latest book, and it's called Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. And let me just first introduce him here for you. Dr. Christopher Kirk, well, he's a medical doctor and PhD. He's the CEO and Chief Medical Officer at Hospice in Buffalo. Kerr earned his MD as well as a PhD in neurobiology and completed his residency in internal medicine at the University of Rochester. Now, his research has been received internationally and has been featured in the New York Times, Atlantic Monday, on the BBC, and many other networks. And of course, as his book becomes more and more popular and out there, it's definitely going to be, I think, a bestseller because it really addresses the subject of passing on, of dying, and what the studies indicate from people who have had the near-death or death experiences. And I'll bring him up in just a second, but I just want to tell you that because Dr. Christopher Kerr is a hospice MD, of course, all of his patients pass away. And he has cared for thousands who, in the face of death, speak of love and grace. And beyond the physical realities of dying are unseen processes that are remarkably life-affirming. And we're going to be talking about all those processes and how this book can sort of change your life and give you a different perspective on dying and the death experience and what people have experienced. So let me just bring him up here on the air. We'll get it with the engineer. Hello, Dr. Kerr. Thank you so much for being on the couch with me today.
Thank you, and thank you for such a lovely introduction.
Oh, well, you wrote a lovely book, and you're very welcome.
Thank you.
As I said at the top of the show, I've never really read a book like this because it encompasses statistical studies, observations, classifications of the pre-death experience, and it is based on science. But there are so many, as I would say, mystical and life-changing for those who are living and possibly those who are dying, experiences just before they pass. So if you can share a little bit, why did you decide to write this book?
My things to do was probably last on the list. what actually happened was I originally started noticing when I started, as soon as I started working at hospice in 99, that my nurse and pastoral care and volunteer and music therapy colleagues had a deep appreciation for the non-physical aspects of dying. And kind of out of frustration in trying to teach this, the response I got so often was that there was no evidence.
Right.
So I ended up doing a series of studies that got very little reception in the medical community. And I learned that I was kind of holding the wrong end of the stick.
Right.
Because what ended up happening was ended up getting into the non-medical community. And
yes.
It took off internationally. And what I was struck by was this was, for many people, the first time these experiences were put in a context in which they could understand or at least have them validated.
Yes.
And it was really overwhelming for people who are either facing end of life or who are grieving. And it was based on really that response that propelled the book.
Yes.
It was really the feedback.
Yes.
That came after first having gone through the medical community, and which is really interesting because
sure.
there's a gap, obviously, between the people who are providing care and the people who are receiving it.
Right. It sure is. But, you know, I really honor you for your work, and I really appreciate in the book also how you discuss many of the cases and share such compassion, you know, and love for your hospice patients. So that's something else, you know, too, that, gosh, please don't take this wrong, but in terms of many medical doctors who I work with, you have such deep compassion and caring. I mean, I'm not saying that they're bad or anything, but there's just, you know, there's a lot of depth to how you connect with these patients.
Thank you.
You know, really.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
Well, I'm very privileged to work kind of in the hospice model of care that gives the doctor a number of things, and one of them is really protected time to get to know patients as people and in the context of their lives and their families and the people they love. And it's also, it was framed deliberately as a multidisciplinary approach.
Right.
So you really get to take people in care of people in totality.
Yes.
So it's really because of that model of care, which has allowed me to practice in this way.
Sure. And well, that's lovely. But you mentioned that you sort of had an aversion in a way to the non-physical and spiritual aspects of dying. So have you sort of changed that a little bit? And is that probably because of a lot of your medical training?
Yeah, I have to say I was the last one in the church, sort of thing. It wasn't. When I was 12, my father passed, and I was at his bedside the day before, and he was trying to play with the buttons on my shirt, saying we were going to go on a trip to go fishing, which we did every year.
Yes,
and you know it was a sort of. Had this sort of effect that it's not something I ever spoke about, and I ended up going into medical school. And as I said in the book, if you have an aversion to death, that's a pretty safe place to be, because you don't focus much on dying. You know that's usually equated with medical failure or futility. And what happened was I was in cardiology training. And just needed an extra income and actually saw an ad for weekend help at a hospice, which I actually didn't know what the job entailed. And I came here.
Wow.
And I was immediately struck by what I had seen as a child.
Yes.
Were people reaching and calling out to those they had loved and lost. And so it kind of followed me.
Yes. Right.
And it was really, I honestly didn't put the dots together till writing the book.
Right.
And,
isn't that amazing? Well, it is very interesting. Isn't that lovely how things just come into play and work out? So you've created this wonderful read for everybody. By the way, in case you just tuned in here, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle here on LA Talk Radio. My special guest today is Christopher Kerr, MD. He's written an amazing book. It's called Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. We're talking about that book today, and I know you guys will want to pick it up. Want to get a hold of it because it just brings so much meaning. For me, it absolutely did. And you know, I also had some similar shared experiences with some of my relatives who I was with when they passed. So I was like, oh, he's right. This is exactly what's going on. So in your book, you talk about many of the lovely people who are having those pre-death experiences. And you say they're just a fraction of the number of individuals that you studied. So if you can talk a little bit about your studies, how many people did you interview for your studies? And what
well,
was...
Well, in total, we're probably somewhere between 1,400 patients and their families.
Mm,
and we've done separate studies, about 700 and 50 people, just looking at the bereaved, because this obviously has implications for grief and loss.
Sure.
So we've been doing it for a long time. And you know, to bring home the point, because we all have kind of a preconceived notion of what these patients look like, which is they're probably feeble-minded. We actually videotaped a lot of people.
Oh, lovely. Oh, that's wonderful.
And which is interesting because that actually footage became core elements of a full-length documentary that's in the film festivals now and in a Netflix episode that's coming in the fall.
But
originally it was done just to prove a point to the doctors, which is, you know, see, they're not confused. They're actually intact and insightful.
That's exactly right. And many times we aren't there for our relatives or loved ones who are passing. And we get the reports, as I did, from the caregivers or the nurses, that kind of thing, about what they were saying and experiencing. So it's lovely. So about 1,400 studied and then 750, of course, as well. What's the difference between visions that people may say that they're having or seeing around them and the dreams that were reported by the patients who were dying or by the observers, as I mentioned, working in the study? Or...
It's a great question. Mm. And both terms are actually probably... not the best descriptors, but they're the only reference point or nomenclature that we have.
Right.
If we're to believe our patients, what they're telling us, when they, in our first study, we did a standardized questionnaire of patients every day until death. Mm. So it's really important that people understand we're not talking about the moments before death when people are probably clearly confused or have altered awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were telling us was that on a scale of realism, 0 to 10, it was 10 out of 10. And the thing we heard most commonly was, no, you know, I don't normally dream or I don't normally recall my dream, but this is what transpired. When we asked them whether it occurred in sleep or wake periods, half the time they were saying they were wakeful, and which automatically takes it out of a dream category.
Yes.
But what's interesting is that so often it's not like you're walking in and they're pointing to people you can't see like you would expect with the vision.
Hmm.
And what we think is the sleep architecture is so changed in dying because dying is progressive sleep. And levels of alertness and awareness change.
Right.
So sleep architecture kind of goes by the wayside and they may be in fact be lucid dreaming. But either way, either way, the experience is profoundly real to them.
Yes. Exactly.
So, yeah, that's the only terms we have is dreams and visions, but it's hard to use those words when they say, no, this is different. And it's so virtual to them that many of them recall it as an actual memory.
Yes.
Which is really interesting.
It really is. And just, you know, to share, be a little transparent here, I recall my father's caregiver had called me and he said, come on over, come in. And I got there and he was still, you know, alive. He had cancer and he was in hospice and he said, oh, your dad's been talking to his father. And I said, really? He said, oh yeah, he's having conversations with dad. And I said, oh, that's great. When I got there, he was pretty quiet. He wasn't having those conversations anymore. And I was holding his hand and just quietly sitting there with the caregiver. But my dad then took my hand, grabbed it, held it really tightly, and then pushed me away, physically pushed me away. Like, go away. I want my time now. I'm going to do my thing. Literally, I mean, it was a forceful push and pushed me away. And so I got the hint and I sort of stood in the back of, you know, the room and he passed away. So it was almost like saying, okay, I've had my conversation. Now,
I've done my work.
Yes, have you?
Well, that's actually very, that's really interesting. That's very classic. So what we found was when we actually asked people to report the content, what we found is as they get closer to death, there's a dramatic increase in frequency. Mm. And when you look at what the themes of what they're seeing, the content, overwhelmingly, it's the deceased, the ones they loved. Mm. And when you measure comfort as it pertains to content, the greatest comfort was assigned to seeing the deceased.
Yeah. Oh,
so there's this built-in mechanism in the dying that as they get closer to death, they're seeing their loved ones, and that actually gives them the most comfort.
Hmm.
And it's interesting because it almost gets edited. The people who withheld or conditioned love aren't in the dream.
Right.
And and so you'll often hear that, you know, somebody has a mother and a father, and the father was the nurturing one, and the mother the opposite. And so the mother isn't there, but the father is.
Oh, that's interesting.
So there seems to be this final kind of scale.
Yes.
Of who's in them. Yeah.
That's interesting because, you know, you see all these in movies, right, about the reconciliation, that final reconciliation, that, you know, dad who's passed away as well, who is not so wonderful and fuzzy, comes back and apologizes and says, it's all okay. And I don't know if you've seen any of those kind of experiences.
Yeah, no, that's a very common and actually, the way we came to that was about 17% of them had a distressing element. But some of those, we kind of got it wrong. We viewed it kind of in a binary term, comfort or distressing. But when you actually looked at it, some of the distressing ones were the most meaningful or transformative because they involved themes of forgiveness.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. What are the differences? Now, this is what was sort of, I was really trying to figure this one out, between the end of life dreams or experiences and normal dreams. I mean,
quite different. One is they're much more organized. They're thematically kind of tied to the deepest, most important elements of having lived. Very little seems to be said between people, although there are some that do, but everything seems to be understood. So there's this implied understanding. The detail, the vividness, the recall, all those things seem to be more distinctive at the end of life.
Isn't that something? That is amazing. By the way, in case you just tuned
people
in.
Go
right ahead, Dr.
Right, people don't talk about them. Yeah. Sorry, I apologize. They don't talk about them as though they were distant experiences. They talk to them as though they were more actual.
Right. Some quantum neurobiologists would say they are. They're in right now, happening, right? Don't get me started, okay? By the way, in case you just tuned in here, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle. My special guest today is Christopher Kerr, MD and PhD. And he is the CEO and Chief Medical Officer at Hospice Buffalo. And, of course, his research has received international attention and has been featured in many media sources, the New York Times, Atlantic Monthly, the BBC, so many. And you're going to be seeing him as well on many networks coming up. There's also a film coming out, which we're going to briefly talk about. It'll be, I believe, available, you said, on Netflix in the fall sometime. So,
no, there's a separate Netflix episode that's coming out in the fall.
Oh, goody. Oh, good. Oh, that'll be wonderful. So, by the way, guys, if you want to pick up Dr. Kerr's book, you can do so. Dr. Christopher Kerr with a K, D-R, Christopher with a C, Kerr, K-E-R-R.com. Find out more about the doctor and also pick up his book because it's really amazing. It'll really, for me, Dr. Kerr, it gave me a sense of peace and understanding and, you know, just positivity.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
That means a lot. Thank you very much.
Oh, no, really. And because also of the statistics that were overwhelming in terms of their there seems to be hope. There seems to be something else. It at least is putting a lot of people at peace. You know, and
And that was really the idea is that, you know, when we think of dying, we obviously think of what we see, which is a physical lessening or suffering,
right,
and what we feel, which is obviously tragedy and loss.
Sure.
And I think what gets lost is there's another aspect or dimension to dying, which is actually the patient's experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what our work has really tried to capture, is we didn't view this as a keyhole into the afterlife or paranormal, but instead just being able to translate what they were actually able to tell us about what they were experiencing.
Yes.
And that's how this work really came about.
Oh, boy, isn't that lovely.
It turns out it's a far more life-affirming message.
Yes, it is.
And one that the person who's in the bed, just like how you described your father,
mm-hmm.
Their fear of death seems to lessen as a consequence.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, exactly. That's what it seems like. That's in your research. That's amazing. Something else that was fascinating to me, and I do want to get to some of the wonderful cases that you talk about, or cases. I'm just going to, the individuals, the lovely people who you worked with, and the patients who you studied. You have some amazing stories, so maybe we could share a little bit about that as well. Real
sure,
quick question
sure.
First, though, is, experts, doctors who I speak with and situations I've been in, you know, many times with dying relatives, they say, well, you know, he had Alzheimer's or she had cognitive issues. They don't even know what they're talking about, but they seem pretty profound, some of the things they say. So is it possible that people with these issues and cognitive disorders are having these experiences or making some kind of sense of what's going on?
Yeah. It's actually my favorite chapter of the book.
Great.
It's called Of Different Minds, and it discusses a number of different people with Down syndrome, mm-hmm. dementia, etc.
Yes.
And I think one of the things that unfortunately has happened, when we talk about particularly people with dementia, we tend to talk about them in terms of deficit,
mm-hmm.
And
yes.
particularly cognitive deficit.
Oh, yes.
And I think what gets lost in that is that there's also an emotional self.
Oh, yes.
And actually one that they might be very much in touch with. So they may not remember what they had for breakfast that day, but they may remember the dress they wore to their prom.
Yes.
And
yes.
What you find is that these folks actually very much have an emotional tone and texture in their existence.
Yes, they do.
We had we're in Buffalo, New York. We had mm-hmm. a woman recently who was in a long-term care facility, and her daughter goes to visit her, and she's trying to leave the building.
Uh-huh.
And she's actually very close to death.
Yes.
And what she's trying to do, it turns out, is go to Niagara Falls, which is where she got married.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what's telling in that is there's this kind of paradox. She's physically declining and dying,
mm-hmm.
yet emotionally and spiritually, she's very alive.
Yes.
And she's actually reliving the best day of her life.
Wow.
Which was the day she got married.
Ugh.
So she was, in her state of mind,
yes.
That's what she was experiencing.
Yes.
I also describe a woman who was in her 30s, actually, and who had Down syndrome, but was very maternal.
Yes.
Always carried dolls and that sort of thing. And
yes.
She ended up with ovarian cancer with ascites, or a large fluid accumulation in her belly.
Yes.
And in her mind, and when she slept,
right.
She was pregnant.
Oh, my goodness.
And she was giving life.
Yes.
Not her life ending.
Oh.
So I think we lose touch of that perspective, which they own and should be at least honored.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there is really something to... as with some of the patients who I worked with in hospitals, those with dementia, you know, they did have many long-term memories intact. And I heard many stories.
Oh, it's phenomenal. Absolutely.
You know? So
yeah,
the short-term,
just another, yeah.
Exactly. And it was also up to interpretation. Some family members would come in and say, well, that's not quite how it went, but if that's what they want to believe, then that's beautiful. You know, I'm really
it's
happy.
Still their experience.
That's
yeah,
exactly
absolutely.
Right. That's exactly right. So let's talk about some of the fascinating pre-death experiences of some of the lovely patients you discuss in your book. So many cases, and what a great read. So I loved reading about Mary and Frank and Bridget and all the other lovely people. So maybe we can just share a little bit about Mary, first of all, and move on to some of the other folks.
Sure. Actually,
yeah.
Mary was... one of the early patients actually that kind of pushed me towards looking at this.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened, she was in her eighth decade of life and she was nearing the end of her life.
Yeah.
And she was having lots of experiences, and she had four children and they understood all of the references.
Right.
But then she started holding a baby that only she could see.
Mm.
And she
yes.
was naming him Danny, and she was cuddling mm. and kissing him.
Mm-hmm.
And children didn't understand who Danny was. And then what happened was her sister came in from out of state.
Mm.
And as soon as she heard the story, she kind of just froze. And she said, well, Danny was actually her first child who had been stillborn.
Wow.
And the injury had been so great that she had kept it private and never shared it.
Wow.
Which was remarkable.
Yes.
And because here she was at the end of her life.
Yes.
And her kind of life wound was being addressed.
Yes.
And it just speaks to this idea that they're so inherently therapeutic.
Oh, yes.
And whether you wanted to ignore it or not, you couldn't for the sake of the patient.
Yes.
That's
lovely. What a beautiful story. And when you share Frank's story also in your book, you said that his experience was indicative of many patients who seem to be, you know, listening to, as we discussed earlier, or talking to their deceased relatives just before they pass on. So can you talk about Frank a little bit?
Sure. Frank was great. Mm-hmm. He was a pretty rough guy. He
yeah.
was a steel worker and gruff.
Yeah.
And he was very demanding. And I come into round one day and the nurse says, you got to go see Frank. Frank wants to see you.
Mm-hmm.
And his complaint was that his sleep was so disrupted, which does happen
uh-huh.
with the vividness of these experiences. So that was forcing him to wakefulness
mm-hmm.
and he was tired. And I said, what's wrong, Frank? He said, well, it's great to see my Uncle Harry, but I wish he'd shut up.
Oh, my God!
So every time he was trying to sleep, he was, you know, Uncle Harry was at the end of his bed. And so what was interesting with Frank, he then had a very common experience, which is time seems to be a race, and you go back to the formative experiences or the most meaningful events of your life.
Right.
And he ended up going back to 1927.
My goodness.
You know, he was just
yes.
with wonderment, what am I doing here?
Yes.
But then what happened was he had been widowed, and
yeah.
Eventually he was seeing his wife, Ruthie.
Yes. Oh,
and
lovely.
And calling out to her.
Oh.
And that ended up really changing what he felt, because
yes.
he was much more comfortable.
Yes, yes.
And actually asked for no further treatment because he just wanted to be at peace with her.
Yes, yes,
so
absolutely.
So it kind of self-informed him. He self-informed himself as he was going through this process.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, isn't that interesting, though, that this other relative would not shut up? They're just yakking. It's like, I wonder what...
It speaks to how strikingly real these
yes.
seem.
Yes,
yeah.
yes. It's interesting the kind of, you know, to just research the kind of relationship that they both had earlier to see if he was
right.
always trying
yes,
to tell
absolutely.
Him, you know.
Yeah, well, you kind of die how you live. So
yes.
he was doing it with his
wow.
own flair.
So, folks, you better clean up your act. And get no, no, I'm just kidding. No,
yeah.
It's like take care of your issues and work on your conscience and be loving and giving and you know, there you go. Be a good citizen in life and you'll possibly feel at peace at the end. I don't know what that speaks of, but it sounds right to me. And I also oh good. I also love Bridget's story. So if you can share a little bit about her self-described visions and dreams that she talked about before passing.
Sure.
Yeah.
She was a very devout Lutheran.
Mm.
And she went into this, I think, expecting to see angels. And what she saw was the deceased.
Aww.
And she didn't quite know what to make of it. And she saw her two aunts.
Yeah.
Who were just standing and kind of watching over her, which again is not uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
And then what she saw was her mother, who was at just sitting at the table and crocheting. And that's, again, often the case. Frank was unusual. Most of the time, again, it's more of a felt presence or an understanding than it is a narration between or a dialogue between people. And what ended up happening was this really kind of also was informative for the reason to kind of do the research.
Yes.
Is when she was told that this was actually a near universal experience.
Yes.
She was soothed.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
She kind of went from looking at it objectively from the outside in to actually understanding that this was a normative part of the dying for many, many people.
Right.
And she went on really to then every morning come to Sears to really self-reporting what she was and kind of embracing it. And again, I think it you know, to die is to be able to sleep well for most people.
Yes, yes.
And sometimes that's obviously relief from physical suffering, but also psychologically.
Oh, yes.
And she was definitely more at peace in that
lovely
comfort.
Sure. That's lovely. And I'm reading here, and I really enjoyed chapter four. It's you talk about how nothing in your book is meant to suggest that death necessarily comes as a warm embrace, you know, or that all of our dreams or visions are certainly wonderful and consolation and, you know, we feel wonderful because you talk about the study involving
I'm
editing.
Afraid I've lost you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me okay now?
There you are.
There we
sorry,
are.
Yeah, there you are.
So sorry. In your book, in your chapter four, A Last Reprieve, you talk about Eddie's story, and you're explaining that nothing really in the book is meant to suggest that death necessarily comes as a warm embrace all the time, and yet,
no.
You know, you really pointed out some fascinating things about Eddie, but to me, it was an amazing aha experience that he had, so can you share that with the listeners as well?
Sure. Yeah. He had been a self-described, quote, dirty cop who had done a number of things wrong in his career. He had trouble with addiction, faithfulness to his spouse, etc. But he'd done a lot of wrong. But he was also raised very Catholic.
Yes.
And he had enormous guilt.
Oh, dear.
And and a strong need to kind of be cathartic with it and tell everybody. And actually what happened was the New York Times reporter came, this Kaufman, and he couldn't wait to get a hold of her.
Right.
And she's thinking she's going to get a story that's all, you know, rainbows and butterflies. And of course, Eddie lets loose and
yes.
tells her all the horrible things he had done.
Oh, dear.
And it got to the point that there was actually risk of lethality.
Oh, wow.
He was so tormented by his experiences,
yes.
and they had to take the guns out of the home, etc.
Yes.
What ended up happening was that he ended up becoming so self-absorbed that he was going towards torment.
Wow.
And
yes.
then something happened just towards the end of his life. He went into this long sleep, and actually people thought that that may be the time when he was going to pass.
Right.
But he came out of that. And he was just, he was inverted. And he had this, instead of, no one had ever heard him talk about anything but himself and what he had done. And instead, what he did is show his concern for other people.
Right.
And he actually said to his sister, you know, get your stuff together because you're going to go to a wake. It's going to be mine. and then he gestured all his love and again, all his forgiveness.
Yes.
And did the same thing to his daughter and his son. So he ended up kind of making this peace.
Mm-hmm.
But it took these experiences to kind of to get him there. So he may have taken the side door in, but he came out on the right side, having found some sort of comfort.
That's a beautiful story. That is, that's a little bit of an enlightenment that he had at the end there. So that's lovely.
Mm-hmm, very much.
Mm-hmm. By the way, in case you just tuned in, guys, you're on the couch here with Dr. Michelle on LA Talk Radio. And my special guest today is an amazing author and doctor, Christopher Kerr, MD. His book's called Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. It's a wonderful read. It gives hope and meaning for all of us, the living, and you know how sometimes possibly to cope with the understanding of what may be happening to certain people before they pass away, based on studies, based on 1,400 plus 750 patients and their experiences, visions, dreams, etc. It's a fascinating read. And it's also approached compassionately, which I really appreciate by you, Dr. Kerr, the way you're writing about this. And you have such affection and caring for all of your patients. So that's lovely. Something I'm going to just kind of veer off quickly to something else, and I'm just going to throw this at you. Because I read a lot about near-death experiences. You have too, I'm sure. Folks who've supposedly been declared as clinically dead but have come back due to whatever. I don't know, resuscitation orders or that kind of thing. But they do report going out of their bodies, and you've read all that. You've seen and heard all that. Going to the light, seeing those who've passed, things like this. Many different experiences are reported. But do you find that these are very similar to what you are hearing and have heard with those?
No, very different.
Okay.
I don't know a lot about near-death experiences, which, as you said, is when people are clinically dead and or close, and then return.
Yes,
we're talking about people who are actually going on a clear path of terminal decline.
Yes,
and from what I'm not that informed. Before I can tell the differences, we don't hear a lot of tunnels and lights.
Right.
And I think the biggest difference is the near death people come back with a need to change or inform or message, or we're given a message, that sort of thing.
Yes.
And in our patient population, they don't come out of this with questions.
Yes. Yes.
Or a need to analyze. Yes. And if you think about it, the time for therapy is over.
Right.
And they're coming, they're left with an understanding. And when you watch some of the videos, it's actually very hard for them to find words for what they're experiencing. Mm. But they don't come out and say, hey, doctor, what do you think?
Yeah.
I saw this, this, and this. I've never had it happen.
Yes.
They just come back with some clear, informative state, not needing to proselytize or anything like that.
Yes. Isn't that interesting? And they're, you know, there have been cases, and we've heard about things, NDEs and things like that. And I actually, have a friend who is a psychotherapist, and she's never religious and never been spiritual and just very scientific and is lovely and works with many patients to help them with their children, actually. And she ended up having an NDE. She had a stroke and was declared, she said, I was almost toe-tagged. She's very funny. She's from the South, she's cute. And she did. She had this out-of-body with the watching them working on her. On the table in the hospital, in the operating room. And then she was looking towards the light, moving up, feeling peaceful. And then felt this whatever that said, no, you've got things to do. You have kids. You've got to take care of them, and you have a life to do. And boom, back in her body, breathing, and was very angry because she was in a lot of pain. But
right.
So that, we've heard those
That's
experiences.
Interesting. Yeah. I think they're, and it makes sense that they would be different.
Sure. It really does.
It's a very different vantage point and perspective, either on both sides. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Another really interesting subject that you brought up in your book is about how we've all heard or experienced the story of elderly couples who die within days of each other. So this thing about a broken heart is real, isn't it? Dying of a broken heart.
Yeah, very much. Mm-hmm. And it's the same way that we see people hang on for various things.
Yes.
Somebody's wedding, a birth, Christmas or celebration, what have you. It takes a lot of work to be sick.
Yes.
It takes a lot of strength.
Mm-hmm.
And people will fight through remarkable things, even at a very subconscious level.
Yes.
And the analogy I always give is, it's like if you've had children and it's Friday night and they're teenagers and they're out, you probably know they're safe, but you can't quite go to sleep until they're in your home.
That's true.
And it's kind of like that. If you have unfinished business responsibilities, that kind of thing, it's often hard. So I think, and again, it speaks to this notion that, you have to be at peace to sleep you have to be asleep to let go to die.
Yes.
And so it's often very true that when we have a lot of people who are almost codependent in their care for one another, and when the one passes, I think the other one feels. So I think there's that phenomena. And then, of course, there is the element of just grief and sadness and the you know, the broken heart syndrome, which is a thing.
Sure.
But I think what we see in couples is just a longing to get back to them.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And in the book, I tell the story of Sonny and Joan.
Yes.
And, he tells her, she tells him, they actually knew each other from they were 11 years old. They were both children of Polish immigrants here in Buffalo. And he actually gave her a ring at the age of 11, a toy
that's
ring.
That's so wonderful.
That they still have, that the grandchild wears.
Oh, my God.
You know, they were both in hospice together, and she was insistent that he stay alive to their anniversary. And then they had a party, and then she kicked everybody out of the room.
Yes.
The daughter returns, and Joan's crying, and she says, "Mom, what's wrong?" She goes, "I told him he can go now."
Oh.
And he died the next morning.
Oh, my goodness.
But what was interesting was that she essentially never stopped feeling his presence, because when she would sleep, she would call out, you know, "Sonny, come get me."
Sure.
And she lived with the family, so the family would hear her. So he was never anything but tangible to her until she died a few months later.
My goodness.
And the family's been videoed, and they're just remarkable telling the story.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's just such a great story. And we all have heard about those stories as well. And that's lovely
absolutely.
That you share that in your book. And let's see, probably the best way for folks to get a hold of your book, which is Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End, Dr. Kerr, is on the website, Dr. Christopher Kerr, and it's Dr. D-R, Christopher with a C, Kerr with a K, .com, right? That's the best way, you think?
Yes, that's
all right.
It.
Yep. All right.
Thank
Wonderful.
You.
Wonderful. Well, thank you.
And what's nice, if you go to the site, is there's a playlist of videos. Because they're the best messenger on this topic, is to actually hear from the patients and the families. And again, we've done lots of studies on the bereaved showing there's actually demonstrable benefit in the grief scales and measurement of how people process loss. And that's on there as well.
Oh, they sure are. They're wonderful to watch. Also, check out Dr. Kerr's TED Talk on his research, because it's fascinating. I mean, I just found it fascinating, the number of the statistics about how many people have the same types of visions and dreams and the themes that were most popular and things like that. So it's a great TED Talk as well. But thank you for everything you do and for bringing this book out to give people.
Thank you very much. And it's been wonderful talking with you.
Oh, you too, Dr. Kerr. We'll meet again. Take good care, and thanks again.
I hope. Thank you.
Yeah, you will.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. All right. Again, Christopher Kerr, MD, PhD, and he is the CEO and Chief Medical Officer at Hospice Buffalo, and he's been researching, you know, the passing of people for years and some of the characteristics and what he's seen over a decade of quantified data on what happens, you know, with people pass away, and it's really enlightening. And this is medically statistically based, and also, you know, as Dr. Kerr said, it took off as well in the spiritual community, because it's just amazing some of the things and experiences that people have reported. So beautiful read. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. I appreciate you being on the couch with me today. You take good care of yourselves, and I always say, do that first. Take care of yourself first, and you'll be great for others. Thanks for listening, and have a great day. Bye-bye.